This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with Bud Johnson, the former LSU Sports Information Director. Bud will comment on the death of Billy Cannon. Passed away yesterday at the age of 80, LSU's only Heisman Trophy winner and one of the most legendary figures in the history of college football, a man who led a full life, to say the least. Also on the show, Diane Andrews on the right, Susan Nelson on the left, commenting about Governor John Bel Edwards preparing for another special session starting tomorrow, and the 16-month anniversary of Donald Trump's presidency. And we'll hear from Tyler Bridges, advocate reporter. He'll have the latest on what happened with the Harris deal. The deal fell through Friday night. We'll talk about it with Tyler Bridges. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and glad you're starting your week with us. And it was a busy weekend. The royal wedding, of course, was the talk of the world. And then, less than a day later, Baton Rouge lost its greatest sporting legend in Billy Ab Cannon. 80 years old, was number 20, the only number that LSU has totally retired. Recently, Jerry Stovall and Tommy Casanova have had their jerseys retired, but players continue to wear numbers 21 and 37. But nobody has worn number 20 for LSU since Billy Cannon, with the possible exception of Gavin Gray, Dennis Quaid, and everybody's All-American, but that really didn't count. But Billy Cannon had a full life. As we know, he fell from grace in 1983, 35 years ago, when he was caught up in a counterfeiting caper, of which he ended up pleading guilty and serving 4 years in prison. But he had a comeback of renown, spent more than 20 years as the dentist at Angola. And when he came to LSU in the mid-1950s, after a brilliant career at Estruma High School, Billy Cannon was one of the most heavily recruited backs in the land, and he chose LSU, and Paul Dietzel, the Tigers' young coach, who got the job when he was all of 34, and he recalls his first practice at LSU and Coach Dietzel giving him a chewing out, and Billy Cannon, being the man he was even then, responded in kind. And a few years ago, in a conversation at the Lott Cook Center, with Billy Cannon, this is how he described his first showdown with Pepsodent Paul Dietzel.
He opens the door and he gets someone in his office and he asks him to excuse us. And I went in and it was he and I. And he chewed me up one side and down the other. Who do you think you are? And this goes on for, seemed like an eternity, 10, 12 minutes. And finally he said, do you have anything to say? I said, yes, sir, I do. Well, what is it? I said, Coach, I've been poor all my life, but I have never, ever worn somebody else's shoes, and I'm not going to here. I said, now you told me at my mama's table and in my mama's house that you were going to run a first-class organization, and wearing somebody else's worn-out shoes is not first class. Going to practice. Well, I went to practice in my high school shoes. About 4 days later, Mr. Bookman said the desk didn't have his smirk on. He said, Billy, here's your new shoes. Brand new pair of low quarter Rydells, the best that they make.
That was the man, Billy Cannon, who got his new shoes, and the rest, as they say, is history. Most notably, his 89-yard punt return to beat Ole Miss in the year of 1959 on Halloween night. And later in the hour, we'll talk with Bud Johnson, the former LSU Sports Information Director, who reminds me that that appearance a few years ago was actually at the Andoni Museum, where Bud was holding court in those days as the manager. We'll hear from him. We'll also hear later in the hour from Tyler Bridges, the advocate reporter, on the collapse of the Harris deal Friday night and the waning days of the regular legislative session. Tomorrow, Governor John Bel Edwards opens a special session, and the governor is trying to get the fiscal cliff addressed. And, of course, there is some pushback. Susan Nelson, who has many hats that she has worn, former executive director, actually communications director of the Louisiana Democratic Party, among others, and now the executive director of the Louisiana Partnership of Children and Families. She is on the left, and Diane Andrews, noted talk show host, Diane Andrews in Black and White, and an activist in her own right, is with us telephonically. But let's start with you, Susan. As far as Governor John Bel Edwards, here we are now less than 17 months from the next election. Are there political components in play as he prepares for a special session?
Oh, absolutely. And good morning. Thank you for having me here this morning, Jim. You know, we've got to look at this opportunity to save the state of Louisiana right now, and certainly there's a lot riding on this for Governor Edwards, but I think there's also a lot riding on this for the legislature, who has refused up until this point to do what they need to do to get this done. And there's been a faction of people who have just continued to resist it simply because it was some of the things that the governor proposed. So I hope that everyone can get their act together, because right now it's for real. We are on the fiscal cliff, and we will be there on June 30th.
Diane Andrews, what's your take on Governor John Bel Edwards, who is running for re-election and obviously will face some stiff competition, most likely from U.S. Senator John Kennedy next year? What are your thoughts about where the session is and how important this is for the governor to address?
Number one, thanks for having me. Also, Jim and Susan, nice being on the program with you this morning. I agree with everything that Susan has said on the issue of the governor. I think the special session starts tomorrow, doesn't it?
It does start.
And I think there are a lot of issues that have to get cleared out, and people need to come together, Democrat, Independent, Republican, and work together for the betterment of the state of Louisiana. The TOPS program, higher education, I know it's only certain parts of this, of the $3.4 billion, it's only $1.1 billion that can be touched, and it's a shame that a lot of that is in education that keeps this state going, and hopefully we'll keep it going on in the future with higher class, better education for all students in the state of Louisiana that are our future.
Well, we'll be following the session with earnest, and we'll be talking some more about this with Tyler Bridges later in the hour. Diane, I know you're a person who follows popular culture, and there was nothing more popular Saturday than the wedding at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, and it had quite a flair to it. Reverend Michael Curry, the Most Reverend Michael Curry of the United States, stirred the congregation, quoting Martin Luther King in a sermon that had some reaching for hankies and others shifting in their chairs. This was a new development, quoting from the Song of Solomon in the Bible, "Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it." It was like an old-time spiritual revival. What did you think?
I think he's out of Chicago. Of course, he's the first Black to ever present, and he presented from his iPad. So it shows how contemporary this ministry is, and I think Prince Harry and Markle, his wife now, Meghan Markle, will be those kind of people. I know they're very into the Royal Foundation, which main interest and goals deal with mental health around their country, around all the, you know, their countries and commonwealths that they have around the world. And I think this just shows a changing of the guard somewhat, although Meghan Markle was written a consent by the Queen. She wore the tiara from Queen Mary on her head, but she wore also a British gown by Givenchy. So I believe that you will see both a traditional but also a new turnover in the four of them, especially. I think now that Prince Harry is married to an American, half Black American, and who Prince Charles met her as she walked halfway down, and he took her the rest of the way down because her father, a Caucasian man, was sick and is sick. So I think you find a difference now with them coming along.
Okay, well, there was a time not so long ago when this couple would not have been allowed to be married in the United States. There's at least one country club where they could not be members here in Baton Rouge right now, being a mixed-race couple. Susan Nelson, does this say a lot about where we are in the world and perhaps where some entities need to get to be part of contemporary America and contemporary world views?
Absolutely. I think, you know, you're seeing a shift in the way the world works and things that are going on display and showing these modern couples that really, since, you know, all the way back since to, you know, Loving v. Virginia, having that opportunity to be who they are with who they are, mm-hmm. and across the spectrum, whether it's race, whether it's gender, whether it's whoever, I think the world is starting to change. And unfortunately, I think it's also causing a lot of angst for a lot of people throughout the world, that's caused some problems.
Well, you teach at the Southern Law School, which is probably the most integrated entity in the state of Louisiana. It truly is, I think, about 50-50 black and white. How is that experience? Do people, do you think they benefit from it, or is it an impediment to what you're trying to get done?
You know, as a person of my background of being Caucasian and coming into a historically black college and university, it greatly enriched my life because I got to learn from some experiences of people that I probably would not have learned from otherwise. And I think a lot of other students share that experience when they come to the Law Center. You get to understand what people's experiences are. So when you read in the media about someone being harassed by the police or stopped and you know, arrested for sitting in a cafe, you know that those stories are real because your classmates have told you the exact same stories. And I think that that's a big change that we can make in our society because there's a lot of people who have that experience.
We're hearing the voices of Susan Nelson, who is Executive Director of the Louisiana Partnership Children and Family. She's on the left, and Diane Andrews, host of Diane Andrews in Black and White, is on the right, and we'll talk with them about President Trump. Yesterday was the 16-month anniversary of his tenure. We'll discuss it. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Another segment with Susan Nelson and Diane Andrews. And as noted, yesterday was the 16-month anniversary of Donald Trump's presidency. So if he serves his full 4 years, which most people expect he will, we are one-third of the way through the first term of Donald John Trump. One-third of the way through. And, of course, if he were to serve 8 years, then we got a long ways to go. But Diane Andrews, your grade of our president through the first one-third of his first term.
I would give him a B+.
A B+. And why is that?
Because I think when you look at the things, a lot of the media, as he calls it fake, and other people may call it fake, don't talk about all of the accomplishments of Donald Trump. People even say, and I will give President Obama credit, because in 1 year you don't influence everything to turn around in the economy. But in Trump's first week, he started taking off some of the executive orders, which were regulations on businesses. He also has our economy now up to almost 4% GDP, and it was never, it didn't even get to 2% under Barack Obama.
I think it's actually around 3. It's not. But anyway, keep going.
3.2. Okay, about 3.2% GDP, but it's almost double. It's 50 to 70% higher than it was the last years. Unemployment for blacks and Hispanics are the lowest in history ever in the country, and unemployment is about 4.1, I think, Jim, around that. He's done some SBA loans improvements to give women a targeted $500 million targeted for women in the SBA. So approvals, I think, has been one of the biggest things that have helped the economy. He cut a lot of permit approval processes and cut regulation red tape.
All right. You're on a roll, and I wanted Susan to respond. A B+, do you go higher than that, Susan?
No. I'm going to go with a solid D-. You know, yeah, there's been a lot of regulation repeal. Let's talk about what the EPA has done in places like West Texas, where there was a fertilizer plant that killed students who were in school, killed people in the small town community of West, destroyed, leveled two elementary schools. And now the EPA has rolled back the restrictions that allow local communities to know what actually is being stored in their facilities. And more importantly, how to safely store the nitrate that was responsible for the explosion.
Okay, well, you believe he's done a terrible job. The economy does appear at this point to be doing relatively well. Of course, it did relatively well under President Obama. But doesn't Donald Trump deserve some plaudits for this?
You know, I think largely, I mean, at this point in time, it hasn't gone down, so he deserves the credit for not tanking it, I think, at this point. But, you know, I think a lot of the things were in place throughout the Obama administration and some manufacturing things. I'm really concerned about this trade war that we're getting into and some of the things that are going to impact some of the trade and manufacturing, particularly here in Louisiana, where we have a lot of exports that we export to China. What's going to happen to our people here in Louisiana?
Two stories today above the fold in the New York Times, the newspaper of record in our country. The special counsel, Bob Mueller, hopes to finish by September 1st the investigation into whether President Trump obstructed the Russia inquiry, according to the president's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. And President Trump yesterday demanded that the Justice Department investigate whether the department or the FBI infiltrated or surveilled his campaign at the behest of the Obama administration. Your thoughts, Susan?
You know, we have a long history of this in the country, and, you know, thank God Lyndon Johnson was listening to Richard Nixon's conversations with the Vietnamese during his campaign. You know, when things start happening with foreign nations during campaigns, absolutely the United States has a right to be engaged in that. And I think that's what we're talking about here. And I think more and more information is going to come to light that there was undue influence by the Russians in our campaign, in our election process. And I think it was absolutely justified of the government to be aware of what was going on.
Diane Andrews, do you think the Russian probe is going anywhere?
I think they have expanded it too far, but they did turn it over to the U.S. attorneys there. When you get into the Stormy Daniels, it's like I didn't agree with what they did with Bill Clinton at the time. I think when you get into personal issues, after a year plus, they don't seem to have a lot of concrete information about what has really happened between them and Russia. If you have not found it out enough to pin this president on it now, I don't think you have a lot underneath it.
All right, Diane Andrews. Her show is In Black and White, which is on cable channels all over the state of Louisiana. She discusses topics nationally and locally. And Susan Nelson, adjunct professor at Southern University, a lawyer who is licensed in how many states now? Three states. She obviously is on opposite sides with Diane Andrews. The Stormy Daniels thing. There are people who were steadfastly in the camp of Bill Clinton during the Lewinsky affair who are slamming Donald Trump, and then there are people who said Clinton had to go who say Donald Trump needs or should get a mulligan. Susan, your thoughts about the double standard on both sides on this story?
You know, as far as I'm concerned, the moral issues of who he slept with and when is not really at issue here. The issue is the payment to her, which is considered a FEC violation because it was meant to influence the outcome of the election because he didn't want that story coming out right before the election. And so first he didn't make the payment he knew nothing about the payment. The lawyer made the payment. And then all of a sudden now he did make the payment. So if he did and the intentions were to influence the election, that's a problem. I don't really care what he did. The problem is that he spent the money to try to cover it up in an effort to change the outcome of the election.
Well, Diane, since there was hush money involved, it appears there almost certainly was a relationship between the president and Miss Stephanie Gregory Clifford, better known as Stormy Daniels, Pride of Scotlandville, Magnet High, 1997. So there was a relationship, and this was when his wife had just given birth to Baron, the son that they have. Does that say something about the man's character?
I don't, as with Bill Clinton, I mean, I think we can go back to every president, even Obama, and find some things about their morality and their character, but I don't believe that, yes, and I'm not going to get into that. And there are things that have been said, and I'm definitely not going to get into it on public radio or
I don't think there's ever been any evidence that he paid hush money to a porn star.
No, not hush money, not like that. No, and I don't think Monica Lewinsky was ever paid hush money, but I'm talking about morality. I don't believe that should be a part. Now, if he did, if it's proven it was hush money and it was illegal hush money, if it's his hush money, I don't care who he paid. That has nothing to do with him being president of the United States. If you want to pay somebody, if he paid her $135,000 to sleep with him one night, which she said it was only one night, that's between him and her. If he paid her nothing. If he paid her $1 billion, that's...
All right, Susan, your thoughts?
Yeah. Again, I mean, from the moral standpoint, you know, the religious conservatives didn't really support Bill Clinton. But they have in overwhelming droves supported Donald Trump, who's been married three times and now we know had this relationship. The hypocrisy of it really speaks to you. The fact that Christian conservatives really don't care about what people do. They care about what people say.
All right. Lastly, a 17-year-old student in Texas, Santa Fe, Texas, he's under arrest, 10 dead in a shooting, the 22nd school shooting in the United States this year. The young man apparently used his father's guns in the attack. Is there anything that can be done to thwart this kind of tragedy?
You know, and I'm a gun owner, so, you know, I'm in favor of people's ability to own and have firearms, but we've got to do something to restrict this. And maybe it's something like insurance that says you're liable for whatever your gun is used for, no matter what. And maybe that'll get people to control their weapons, lock them up better, keep them more secure, keep them out of the hands of their 17-year-olds. I don't know what the right answer is, but it certainly is something we need to discuss.
Diane, should we ban assault weapons in this country?
Well, I read a little bit about this young man. He was a great young man. He also wore a trench coat. I did a show in my Diane Anderson Black and White TV series, and I'm also in Texas and Mississippi.
What does a trench coat have to do with anything?
I did a show on Columbine, and they have become folk heroes. Those two young men who killed all the kids in Columbine, you know, kind of the first biggest one ever. Then he wore this black trench coat and did some of the same actions that they were doing. So I don't know. A lot of this turns out to be mental illness.
Well, the trench coat didn't kill anybody, Diane. The gun killed people.
No, it didn't. But I'm back to I don't own a gun, but I do believe there should be universal background checks. But
all right, we got to roll. But thanks to both of you. Good to have you with us. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We switch gears just a bit, and we're joined by Tyler Bridges, the intrepid reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner. He worked for many years for the Picayune and for the Miami Herald, and he's been covering the Capitol the last few years for the Advocate, and there's much going on at the state capitol. Seems like the beat goes on and on and on, and tomorrow is another special session, and we'll get to that with Tyler, but Tyler Bridges, has been covering with Ernest the Harris negotiations, and an extension for Harris was expected to be approved last week at the close of the session, and then the bill died at the finish line. What the heck happened, Tyler Bridges?
Jim, good morning, and that's a good question. I expected the bill to pass. For your readers who weren't fully following it, or for your listeners, it was a 30-year extension in the operating contract that Harris has to operate the only land-based casino in New Orleans. The current license expires in 2024, so 6 years early, Harris and their parent company, Caesars, were trying to win another 30 years, and the bill easily passed the House. The bill was sponsored by Taylor Barra, the speaker. Really no House members asked any substantive questions, and then substantive questions began to arise in the Senate.
And in the Senate, John Ilerio had to make the announcement that, quote, "I'm sorry it didn't work out. Our problem is that we didn't have anything to compare it to. We don't know if we're being fair to the state." John Ilerio, of course, as we know, is a measured man, and he says it's just too late and too complicated. Is that a fair assessment of where the Senate was, or is Senator Ilerio buying time as this perhaps crops up again a few months or a year from now?
Well, certainly it could crop up a year from now. Harris, again, and its parent company, Caesars, clearly want an extension of that license, and it doesn't expire to 2024, but they also very much wanted to get it done this year. But Senator Larry, I think, was touching upon something that he had raised and been talking about for a long time and others, which is that there was no independent analysis. The state, the Louisiana Gaming Control Board, the Edwards administration, nobody did an independent analysis of the deal that Harris was offering to determine whether it was really fair or not. And maybe it was a great deal. Logic suggests that if Harris has and Caesars have all the information and the state doesn't have very much, it probably favored the company. But again, we simply do not know.
Well, this is obviously an issue that has political ramifications, and Senator Kennedy was on this show a few days ago and expressed great alarm about the Harris deal, saying he wanted to stop it. And Governor Edwards was showing indications that he would likely approve it if it got to his desk. Will this be a political tool? Will it be perhaps an issue if the race next year comes down to Governor Edwards and Senator Kennedy for the governorship of Louisiana?
It's obviously, we don't know, Jim, but I tend not to think so. It might have been if Governor Edwards had continued to strongly support the deal and had it gone through. But as you said, Senator Kennedy stepped in, and meanwhile in the state Senate, senators stepped in and slowed it down. And so the fact that this extension did not become law probably takes away that issue. And I should mention something also that the Caesars folks were doing, is they said, if you give us this early renewal, this extra 30 years, we will invest $350 million. We'll build a new hotel. We'll create 500 jobs. We'll make other investments. And because the bill did not go through, Caesars is not going to make that investment.
What is the prospect of success for the governor in the special session that begins tomorrow?
Well, we've been through, five of them already. And the first one had a temporary success, and then since then he's run into Republicans in the House saying no to his plans to raise enough revenue to fully balance the budget. From his point of view, certainly he is frustrated. He feels like the Republicans who control the state House have said no to taxes and have also said haven't fully said yes to the budget cuts either, although the House Republicans did just now approve a budget with deep, deep cuts, but I think they did that with the idea that it would not take effect. The leaders of the House, because that's the key thing we should be watching in the next few days, have said they're open to more revenue. I think what we should look for is a half-cent increase, not increase, but a renewal of the 1 cent that's expiring. So the Edwards administration and others will say, hey, this is actually a tax cut, because instead of extending the full penny, only half of the penny would be extended. But we don't know that it will actually go through, because there are Democrats saying that because the sales tax is regressive, then they want the Republicans to agree to some changes on the income tax side, for example, making permanent some tax credits that are now temporarily stopped. And also getting rid of some other tax breaks for them to fully go through. So if both sides can do that, then I think they probably will have success in this special session that begins tomorrow.
But it is far from a done deal.
Yeah. Other states have had budget problems for a long time. Illinois, for months and months, could not figure it out. It would be uncharted territory for the state of Louisiana, as you know, Jim. But I think people are generally optimistic that the two sides will reach a deal by the scheduled date, the scheduled end of the special session on June 4th.
Well, Tyler Bridges, we'll be calling on you again soon, and thanks for your update. And Tyler, by the way, is working on a book about the play being the game and that Cal and Stanford played in 1982, in which the California team took a kick off the distance as the Stanford band came on the field. And Tyler remembers that game, being a graduate of Stanford University, with some dismay. And I think you're the kind of guy who can put it all in perspective, Tyler Bridges.
Well, I'm certainly going to try to do so, Jim. Always glad to be on your show.
Okay, well, before you go, Patrick on Blue Bonnet had been waiting, and I wanted to slide him in. And Patrick, you're on the air with Tyler Bridges. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Tyler, I got a quick question. They say we got a pretend budget. I think it's more like a pretend shortage. I think we have plenty of money to pay for the government. Problem is, we're paying for a lot of entitlements like TOPS, health care. If we cut TOPS, totally cut it, and cut health care, do you think there'd be enough money in the budget to pay for roads, police, you know, fire, good court system, jails, you know, legitimate government functions? I think we.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Tyler?
Sure, you can certainly do that. But what Patrick would see as legitimate government services and things that he would like to cut, I don't think that is the general will of the House and the Senate. There are too many people who see the need for the spending on health care, particularly the spending on TOPS. That's a particular favorite of the House Republicans who do want to make cuts elsewhere. So while some people say cut here, other people say don't cut there. And that's why there's this budget problem right now. But ultimately, people are going to have to make a compromise on both sides for an agreement to be reached.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on Please Be Brief with Tyler Bridges.
You know, I believe one of the articles of impeachment brought against Richard Nixon was using the Internal Revenue Service to punish his enemies. Well, President Trump is using the post office or trying to punish Amazon as a political enemy. Should be an article of impeachment.
All right. Well, that's a story I don't think Tyler is covering, but it does involve the owner of the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon. He may be the richest man in the world. Tyler, as I said, I think you're in the trenches at the Capitol right now, but you do follow the world at large, and we live in a very interesting world right now, don't we?
We do, and I have to say that I think the Washington Post and the New York Times and other media outlets are very aggressively covering, and appropriately so, the Trump administration. You know, and he is fighting back. He's labeled the media as the opposition. I don't think that's a fair comment. Certainly the media over years has done all sorts of critical stories on Democrats as well, and I know that we folks at The Advocate, we on a local level, we don't have favorites of one party or the other. Plenty of Democrats and indeed Republicans have gotten upset at our reporting as well.
And Tyler's last book with Jeremy Alford, Long Shot, is the definitive book about the 2015 election. And I think anybody who's going to follow the 2019 campaign should read Long Shot as a precursor to what happens next year. Thank you very much, Tyler.
Thanks, Jim.
See you soon. And we're joined in studio now by Bud Johnson, former LSU Sports Information Director, author of The Perfect Season, the book about the 1958 team. The last time LSU had an undefeated football season was 1958, 60 years ago. And the star of that team, Billy Ab Cannon, born in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1937. He died yesterday at the age of 80, and Bud Johnson was the man who told me that Billy Cannon had died. And Bud, I know he was a very good friend of yours. I certainly send my condolences to you and all his friends and his large family. But there is a void in this city right now, isn't there?
There is. He was a remarkable human being. If you could have drawn up a plan for a perfect running back, you would have to start with someone like Billy Cannon. He could run a 100-yard dash in 9.4. He was also a world-class weightlifter. I think he was 20 pounds off the Olympic championship weight in weightlifting.
Shot putter.
When he was a student, he was majoring in a pre-dental curriculum. He was essentially working with three sports: football, track, and he was weightlifting. Increase his stamina.
Well, hold that thought. We'll talk about the late, great Billy Cannon after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And Baton Rouge is synonymous with Billy Cannon, who grew up here, was a high school legend at Estruma High School, and then won the Heisman Trophy in 1959 at LSU, a year after leading the Tigers to the national title. His 89-yard run against Ole Miss in 1959 is the most famous play in LSU football history and one of the most famous in college football history. Yesterday, Billy Cannon's long and varied and sometimes controversial life ended at the age of 80. He was about to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the championship season. He wore number 20, the only number never to be worn by another player at LSU. And at the end of his career, the Kansas City Chiefs, his final stop in his football odyssey, he wore number 80. So Bud Johnson, he was a man who was into even numbers, and he died at the age of 80. And for those who saw him recently, he was not the superhuman guy he was when he was a young guy. But he wore his success well, and he certainly came back from a humiliating episode of his own doing. He showed a lot about himself by the way he handled his fall from grace.
Jim, I think you have to marvel what he accomplished as a senior citizen. He was hired, I guess, in 1995 by the Angola Penitentiary as a dentist. He wound up managing the dental clinic at Angola. Now, here again, his versatility, his intelligence, his wit was probably underestimated when they hired him, because he revamped the dental clinic at Angola. He won over, I guess, a clientele that he was ill-prepared for. But when you think about it, he was a streetwise guy with two professional degrees from University of Tennessee Dental School and an advanced degree from Loyola Chicago. He had a university education, but it was his streetwise ability to deal with the inmates that made him a success at that job. Mm-hmm. Those fellows up there, some of whom will never see the outside world again, a hardened group, loved him. And that came along at a time when he needed somebody to care about Billy Cannon. And that that fueled his working life until his 80th year.
And you were in touch with him right up to the end.
I talked to him last week. In fact, we were scheduled to go to Hammond Wednesday to see a friend of his.
You wrote the book, The Perfect Season, and Billy Cannon and Paul Dietzel, Johnny Robinson, Warren Rabb, those are names that are synonymous with LSU, and interestingly, all of the star players on that team, the big stars, were from Baton Rouge, but they came out of nowhere. As you know, in 1957, LSU was 5-5. With a pretty good backfield and Billy Cannon and Jimmy Taylor, who became a Pro Football Hall of Famer. But how did they do it? Was Cannon the catalyst?
He was one of the things that made that team do a turnabout. In 55, they lost, 57, they lost five straight games with Cannon and Taylor in the same backfield. They were shut out by Vanderbilt. When the town of Baton Rouge wanted to talk about anything but LSU football, they were quietly retooling their offense into a wing T. And there was no excitement about that team going into the season. The only people that really had any confidence in their ability to win in 58 were the players. Cannon was excited about that offense. He was excited about the coming season. I asked him. LSU was picked to finish eighth in a 12-team league.
The year they won it all.
Yeah. I'd seen spring practice. I was a young kid. I was kind of excited by what I'd seen. So I said, Billy, do you think we're as bad as eighth in the SEC? He said, no. It's between us and Ole Miss.
Well, Ole Miss in those days, as you know, was if not the best, the second-best program in the country. And in 1959, one of those quirks of fate, Johnny Vaught had his best team, and they beat everybody by huge margins except LSU on October 31st, 1959. LSU beat Ole Miss 7-3 on the 89-yard punt return by Billy Cannon. What do you remember about that?
The thing I remember about that game is it was after the run. You thought, well, we've got him now. Johnny Vaught put in his third-team quarterback, and he took him on the only offensive drive of the night. The rest of the game was all defense.
On both sides.
Right. it ended at the one-yard line with Rabb and Cannon making the stop.
That was Halloween night, 1959, and in 1979, on Halloween night, Billy Cannon Jr. ran 89 yards to give Broadmoor victory over Estruma, his dad's alma mater. Now, what a quirk of fate that is.
I think there was a lot of anxiety about the recruiting of Billy Cannon Jr., but it turned out okay. He had a nice career at Texas A&M. Billy had Texas A&M friends from his days with the Houston Oilers. I think the animosity toward Billy when his son elected to go to Texas A&M was a wound that healed, but that always amused me that Tiger fans mm-hmm. briefly turned on their hero recruiting.
Well, and what would have been the 25th anniversary of the championship team that would have certainly highlighted Billy Cannon, that was marred by the fact that he was arrested and threw himself at the mercy of the court and went to federal prison for a counterfeiting caper. And Charles D. Gravel wrote it very eloquently and elegantly about this in his book, A Long, Long Run, and hopefully we'll talk with Charles sometime this week. But Billy Cannon never shied away from talking about that. I asked him about it on the 50th anniversary of the run, and he was quite open that he just screwed up. That it was not one of his finer moments, but he did it, and he had to take responsibility for it. To put it in the vernacular, he manned up Bud Johnson. He didn't run from what he had done.
Well, that period of his life, I think we really have to salute him for. It would have been easy for him to stay up on his horse farm and concentrate on those horses and be a recluse, but he discovered that this town forgives and remembers. They remembered the good things about Billy Cannon, and they welcomed him back. And the more personal appearances he made, the more he began to love and trust his old friends. And Jim, you well know that he was very comfortable making personal appearances out at LSU. You were the moderator at a number of events at the...
Well, and you're the one who made it possible. I don't think he would have done those without the coaxing of one Bud Johnson, but...
There were others. Boots Garland was instrumental in getting him back in the mainstream of public appearances, and the public was warm in receiving him and encouraging him to do more.
It's interesting that on the last night of his life, I was having a conversation with Mike Robichaux, former LSU all-conference defender who became a state senator. Fascinating guy. And we spent about 20 minutes talking about Billy Cannon, and he noted that when Cannon ran that 9,400-yard dash, the world record was 9,300. So he was the real deal. There was probably no greater athlete in the world at any time than Billy Cannon was in his prime, and he left quite a legacy that went way beyond his athletic heroism, and we'll be talking more about him this week. And certainly we wish Dot and his family very well. Bonnie Cannon, who works at LSU, the very best. We lost a legend in Billy Ab Cannon. Thank you, Bud Johnson. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.